You'll turn in your Bibles to the book of the Revelation, chapter 17. We're going to continue looking at the judgment of the great harlot that's described here in chapters 17 and 18. We began looking last week. We made it for the first four verses, so we'll see if we can make it a little further tonight. Let's go back and read these verses just quickly. We read in verse 1 of Revelation 17, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls," either the bowls of God's wrath, or the final plagues, "he came and talked with me, saying to me, 'Come and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication.' So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication." John is led by an angel, very likely the seventh angel, the one who poured out the seventh bowl of God's wrath, to come and see, and he would say, "I'll show you the judgment," and this is certainly the righteous judgment, "of the great harlot who sits on many waters." We saw in verse 15 that the waters are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues, which kind of gives us a picture of all the people of the earth. And so we see that this great harlot has influence and power over all the peoples of the earth. And so we understand that a little bit about her. It says that she is a harlot. We looked at the fact that it speaks of the word harlot and the word fornication there, and said that while certainly this harlot probably is, engaged in advocating, literal sexual immorality, this is a word that's used to describe spiritual harlotry or idolatry. This harlot is one who has affected the whole nation, or excuse me, the whole earth, all the nations and peoples of the earth, with idolatry and led them into idolatry. The kings of the earth, verse 2, "the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her." So they have been brought under this umbrella of her influence of idolatry in the earth. And not only that, but all the inhabitants of the earth, it says, were made drunk or were intoxicated, or you might say they were carried away with the wine, the pleasure of idolatry. And certainly idolatrous worship does carry with it the pleasures of the world. That's a part of it as well. We look at that. And we look at the fact that this woman is seen. John is carried away in the Spirit, by the Holy Spirit of God, into the future to see this judgment that's about to take place. He's carried into the wilderness, which seems to be nearby this where the harlot is. And this harlot is described as a woman, which seems to fit, sitting on a scarlet-colored beast. Now, the scarlet-colored beast is identified with having names of blasphemy, having seven heads, and having ten horns. And we look and compare. If you look at the comparison, we see back in Revelation 13, where it describes the beast rising up out of the sea. This is the exact description we get of the beast, or the Antichrist. This is Satan's man. This is the son of perdition, who was going to rule on the earth during that tribulation period. And so she is associated with the Antichrist. In fact, the Antichrist will support her. She rides on this, she's sitting on this scarlet-colored beast. So he is at least supportive of her initially. Now that support will not last. It will eventually be replaced, and we'll see that as we get farther down in chapter 17. But initially he is supportive of that. So this idolatry of this harlot permeates the whole world and is supported by the beast. And so you can see that you're going to have a worldwide worship that is idolatrous in nature during that tribulation period. Now, look at that kind of brings us up where we, in a nutshell, where we went to. Look at verse 5. We read this, but we didn't describe it too much. It says, "On her forehead," it says, "was a name that was written." And it says, "Mystery Babylon, the Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." The forehead in biblical cultures, it was not uncommon to see this was a place where people were identified. We already looked at the fact that in Revelation chapter 7, Revelation chapter 14, the 144,000 are marked with a seal of God in their foreheads that identified them as belonging to God. And so that was true back in the days in regard to that being something that was just common. Followers of the beast will have a mark that they'll take. It'll be in their right hands or in their foreheads. And we saw in Jeremiah chapter 3 that even prostitutes would wear their names on their foreheads and would do so being unashamed. They weren't ashamed to display their names and admit that they were harlots. And that would be true in the sense of this. This woman, this harlot, has a name on her forehead that is Mystery Babylon the Great. Now, I can't remember exactly how far we got. The word mystery, did we talk about this? A little bit. Okay, not much. I didn't think so. I usually mark in my notes how far I got so I remember. So the harlot's name, I don't know that it includes the word mystery. I'm not sure that that's a part of the name. It's written in the King James that way. It's written in the New King James as if it is. But it's not the mystery. It just says mystery, or you could translate it a mystery. I don't believe, and most commentators that I read don't believe that it's actually a part of her name. But it is declaring her name to have been a mystery or a secret until it is revealed. And that's what's happening now. It is being revealed to John what the name of this harlot is and what the meaning of that name is. It's possibly that this is related to what the Apostle Paul describes in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 7, is the mystery of iniquity or the mystery of lawlessness. And that's associated with the man of sin as well. So there are some mysteries associated with Satan's man during the future and with this woman that is described here. And her name is described as Babylon the Great. Now, the great, I think, can be used to describe many ways in which the old city of Babylon was great, headed up by Nebuchadnezzar. It was great in size. It was great in power. It was great in the extent of its rule. When Babylon conquered the world, this is when the times of the Gentiles actually began. It's described in Daniel chapter 2 with the image that Nebuchadnezzar sees. It's described in Daniel chapter 7 with the vision that Daniel sees about the four beasts that have control over Israel. It's what Jesus refers to as the times of the Gentiles, when the city of Jerusalem and the people of Israel were trodden underfoot by Gentile rulers and powers. Nebuchadnezzar was the head, or the head of gold, and the beginning of that rule of the Gentiles. And his kingdom was powerful, and his rule was powerful. It's almost like whatever he said went. He could change his mind, and it didn't matter. The Medes and Persians, who had come along after him and conquer him, had a much less powerful kingdom. They were guided by their laws, the laws of the Medes and Persians. Once it was written into law, a king couldn't change it. That wasn't true with Nebuchadnezzar. He could do whatever he wanted to. So it was great in size, power, the extent, and the authority of his rule over the earth in those days was quite powerful and quite great. But it was also great in wickedness. This was a wicked city. They were given over to idolatry. I mean, remember the story that the book of Daniel opens up with Daniel and four of his friends being brought into Babylon and being basically indoctrinated into the Babylonian religion so that they could become advisors to King Nebuchadnezzar. So they were taught the language, they were given names, and every one of their names had basically the name of one of the Babylonian gods included in their name. They were taught Babylonian traditions. They were taught Babylonian religion and culture. Again, they were indoctrinated in that so that they could advise him. Now, Daniel and his friends would not give in to those things, even though they learned the language, they learned about the gods, they learned the culture, they learned all the practices. They still were true to God and worshiped God. But Babylon was very, very great, especially that was described there under Nebuchadnezzar's rule. And we see that repeated here in the book of the Revelation. And I'll just give you the references because we've looked at them already. Revelation chapter 14, verse 18, it describes as Babylon. And it says, that great city, and it talks about the city being divided by the earthquake that comes as a result of the seventh bowl of wrath. In Revelation chapter 16, verse 19, talks about the earthquake, and it's called Great Babylon, okay, that great city. In Revelation chapter 17, verse 5, here it's called Babylon the Great. And in chapter 18, we see three references to it. It's called, in chapter 18, verse 2, it's called Babylon the Great. In chapter 18, verse 10, that great city Babylon. And then that's repeated in Revelation 18, 21. To me, it all looks like the same thing. I think we're describing the very same thing in every one of these occurrences. There are those who don't believe that, but we'll talk a little bit about that later on. Now notice, go back with me in chapter 17, verse 5. The name also includes this statement, Babylon the Great, clearly identifying this with that old kingdom that began, not with Nebuchadnezzar. When did the kingdom of Babylon actually begin? Yeah, all the way back to the Tower of Babel. Turn back there with me just briefly. Just look at that. Genesis chapter 10. When we think of the Tower of Babel, we usually turn to chapter 11, but we need to back up to chapter 10 to see the leader who began all of this. Genesis chapter 10 is a list of the table of nations that came as a result of the flood. These are all the nations that descended from Noah and his three sons, and so they're described here in groups, and according to each of Noah's sons. Well, one of the sons was Cush. Look at verse 8. Now, Cush, I'm going to take one of the sons. Cush was actually the son of Ham. That was Noah's third son. This is the one who, you know, basically dishonored his father by going in and seeing his father's nakedness after he got drunk when he came off of the ark and so forth. But he had a son named Ham, and then he had a son named Cush. And then look in verse 8, we see it says, "And Cush begot a man named Nimrod." Okay? And it says, "Nimrod began to be a mighty one in the earth." Now, that could be mighty in power, and very likely he was. It could also be mighty in his reputation, a man of renown. Okay? He was a mighty hunter, use the word mighty again, a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, one of the things that was interesting about the changes that took place after the flood was, what did God change in regard to the diet of man after the flood? They were allowed to eat meat. And so, in order to provide for themselves and provide food for their families, one of the things that would have become a very important thing was the ability to hunt. And so, he is described as a hunter. And many people believe that he might have been very good at it and very successful at it and developed a reputation that way. I think it's more than that, though. He was a hunter. If he was a hunter in that way, that may have been what led him to prominence. But he was also a mighty hunter of men. He was a mighty hunter of men's souls. And it says here, a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, that sounds kind of good. That sounds like he did what he did before the face of God. But the way that, and I'm not a Hebrew expert at all, but the ones that I've read that talk about the nature of the Hebrew language here almost give the idea that he was a mighty hunter who basically defied the Lord. He did this before the face of God in defiance of God. Keep reading with me. Verse 9, it says, "Therefore it said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord," or in defiance of the Lord, "and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel." Okay? "Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and the land of Shinar." Now that's exactly where the city of Babylon was. Okay? Was the land of Shinar. So it started as Babel. "From that land he went to Assyria, and he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, and Calah. And Rezin between Nineveh and Calah," that's the principal city. You have two key cities that are described there that rise to prominence in their captivity of and their defeat of the people of Israel. One is Babel, or Babylon. That's the beginning of the kingdom of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. They're the ones who took the southern kingdom of Judah, and as a result of that, the entire nation of Israel was placed under captivity to that nation and that city. But the other is Nineveh. Look at verse 11. Nineveh. Nineveh is the capital of what nation? Assyria. And they're the ones who took the northern kingdom into captivity about 120 years roughly before Babylon took the southern kingdom into captivity. So he's the beginning of both of those cities. He's the beginning of both of those kingdoms. And again, both of them were highly idolatrous in nature. Look at chapter 11. Now, I believe that Nimrod was the leader of everything that we see going on in chapter 11. When Noah and his family came off the ark, what did he tell them to do? What was the instruction? Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Okay, and the idea there, I think, is that they were to basically don't stay here all together in one place. Take your families and multiply and let them spread out and fill the earth with population again. Because the earth population had been destroyed by the flood. It was just them. That's what they were to do. Here's what they did instead. Chapter 11, verse 1. "Now the whole earth had one language and one speech." Makes sense. They all came from one family. All right? He says, "And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar." And what does it say they did? They dwelt there. In other words, they put down stakes. They said, "This is where we're going to live." Now, God didn't direct this, I don't believe. They did, or Nimrod did. And so they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come and let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." Now, it looks like what they're trying to do is they're taking the instruction of God and saying,
That does not sound like a good idea to us. Let's do what we want to do. And you can see that with the pronouns in verses 3 and 4. Let us make bricks. Verse 4, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Now, they're not trying to build a tower to reach the heaven. When you're a little kid and you hear the story for the first time, I'm not even sure my Sunday school teachers didn't tell me this. They're not trying to climb up into heaven. That's not the idea. They're building a top, a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Now, I think primarily the purpose here is very likely, and I can't absolutely prove this, but I think it's very likely that the purpose here is to worship the heavens. Because one of the big things that you will find when you get to the days of Nebuchadnezzar and their advisors, one of the things they looked to find guidance and counsel for the king was they studied the stars. Now, they didn't study astronomy. They studied what we would call astrology. How can I tell the future from studying the stars? It's like you read your horoscope. You know, people sometimes read their horoscope in the paper when there used to be a paper. Anybody still take a paper anymore? Just out of curiosity. My mom just gave hers up. She's probably one of the last holdouts to have an actual newspaper. But you used to give your horoscope in there. You said, what am I day going to be like? Of course, they're so general that, you know, anybody's day could follow me. I could pick anybody's horoscope and read it and probably find something that day that said, yep, see, it worked out just like my horoscope said. But they would literally and genuinely try to determine their future and the king's future and the country's future based on their study of the stars. Even the wise men that came when Jesus was born in Bethlehem, they came because that's exactly what they were. They were astrologers. They studied the stars. And they saw a new star that had never been there before. And they followed it and it led them back to the land of Israel. They recognized, even from prophecies, the biblical prophecies, that this was an indication of a new king that was born. And from the book of Numbers, we see some of those things. So that's what they did. I think that very likely that's what this probably the intent was. It was something to help them in a worship of something other than God. Very obviously, they are defying God's instructions to them. And Nimrod was a man, it seems to be, who defied God and divide God's will and purpose for them. So I think this was the beginnings of idolatry. This was the beginnings of a system and a people and a nation and a city that was going to be steeped in idolatry so that we don't have to be scattered abroad. Well, the Lord came down and we know that He looked at what they were doing, knew what they were doing, knew that what... In fact, look at verse 6. The Lord said, indeed, the people are one and they all have one language, and this is what they... What's the word? Begin to do. This is just the beginning of what they're going to do. Maybe initially it wasn't with the evil intent, but it was going to lead that way. And he knew that was probably in Nimrod's mind. He said, this is what they begin to do. And now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld. If I let them go through with this, it's only going to lead them even quicker into idolatry. So he confused their language. All of a sudden they couldn't understand each other. They all had different languages. And what was the result of that? They were forced to spread out from each other, and they began to group into countries and nations. And that's what we see in Genesis chapter 10, this table of nations that came as a result of the confusion of languages that took place at the Tower of Babel. This is the beginnings of Babylon, led by a man who in a lot of ways is very much like the Antichrist. He was going to lead people in defiance of God to worship something besides God, to worship even the creation of God Himself, and that's what he led. It was continuing into the Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. By the time Nebuchadnezzar is ruling the nation of Babylon, the city of Babylon, they're steeped in idolatry. In fact, even very quickly after the Tower of Babel, even when they spread out, the idolatry is there. When God calls Abraham, where is he living? He's living in the land of Shinar, which is exactly where the city of Babylon, the city of Babylon, kingdom of Babylon, is going to be located. That's where he is. What is his family like? They worship idols. Abraham was an idol worshiper. God called him out of that. That's why he told him, leave behind your family, leave behind your father's house, leave behind your country and go to a land that I will show you. So this is the beginning of it. So look back at Revelation 17. Notice what he says. This is a mystery, I think, is what he's including in it said about this name. The name is Babylon the Great, but two descriptions are given. The mother of harlots and the mother of the abominations of the earth. Now, what does it mean when it says the mother of? Let me give you two examples, I think, of possibilities that we see here. Have you ever heard the expression, necessity is the mother of invention? You know? somebody has a need, so we have this need. God says, let me invent something that'll like take care of that need. So they use that expression, necessity is the mother. It's the source. It's the origin. It's the cause. It's the motivation for something taking place. So Babylon, if we look at it in that sense, is the source or the origin or the cause of this system of worldwide idolatry that will be in existence on the earth during the tribulation period. It begins in Babylon. Its source is Babylon, I think is what he's saying. It's the mother of harlots. It's also the other expression we would find is the, if I say, boy, I was caught in the mother of all traffic jams today. What am I talking about? It's the very worst of all possible. It's a way we use to exaggerate things sometimes. It's language that's used, a way of expressing the large or the grand or the extensive comparison of this thing to everything else. Well, in that sense too, Babylon was a place of the worst abominations that you can imagine. If you read about it in chapter 18 and read about what we're describing here, go back and look at the idolatry that took place in the Old Testament scriptures, the horror of what took place there was terrible. I mean, one of the worst examples I think of is the fact that under the guise of worshiping a god, like Molech or Chemosh, they would sacrifice their own children and burn them in the fire as a sacrifice to these gods. I can't think of anything worse than doing something like that to your own, you know, infant or young children. But that's what they would do. And it didn't matter to them because they're only concerned about themselves. So Babylon is the place where you would find the worst of these things. And we see that in the next verse. Go look at Revelation chapter 17. Move on with me to verse 6. And then he says this. John says, and I saw the woman. Okay, this is Babylon the Great. I saw her drunk with what? With blood. The blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And he says, and when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. It's amazing how many times that word great is found in these several chapters we've been looking at. The last seven judgments, the last plagues, the city of Babylon. So many times it talks about things that are great. Here we see John, when he looks at this, he marvels or wonders with great amazement. Now, drunken. The idea there of drunk is intoxicated. The idea of being intoxicated or carried away. Almost, you might say, in a euphoric condition. But what brings the euphoria to this woman, to this harlot? Blood. Blood of who? Blood of the saints and blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And you might say, well, why those two? You would think that the last one would be enough. I think that that's an indication that the blood is something that certainly includes all of those who are going to be killed during the tribulation period. And there will be many who will be killed during the tribulation period, who are saints of God, who are believers in Jesus Christ, martyrs of Jesus. In fact, look at Revelation chapter 6. We saw this with the fifth seal. I know I keep going back to this, but we always take back the references we go and see how they're expanded as we go further in the book of the Revelation. Verse 9, Revelation 6, 9, when he opened the fifth seal, he says, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And that testimony would have been concerning Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth, okay? They cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And a white robe was given to each of them, and was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed. In other words, there are a lot more who are going to die. Especially during that last half of the tribulation period. That was going to be the greatest time of tribulation for Israel that they had ever seen, and more blood would be spilled. Because he distinguishes and says the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, I think probably this city that's described here, this harlot, is something that extends back even in time, maybe before the tribulation period. Okay, the blood that is shed back ages past, because you think about how many people Nebuchadnezzar killed in Israel in the days of those captivity. It talks about thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people died in the city of Jerusalem alone. when he came in and conquered that city and destroyed their temple. So there were many people killed. Jesus even talked about the blood of the saints and the blood of the prophets that were on the hands of the rulers in Israel. The princes and rulers and priests of Israel had blood on their hands, all going all the way back to righteous Abel, all the way up to the days of Zechariah. From cover to cover in the Old Testament scriptures, blood was shed. Look in the book of Psalms with me. This is prophesied. Psalm 79. And I think this is talking about what's going to take place during the tribulation period. You can see that really in the very first verse. Psalm 79, beginning of verse 1. The psalmist Asaph writes this. He says, "O God, the nations have come into your inheritance, and your holy temple they have defiled." Now, that was done certainly in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes. It was done in his days. But I think this goes beyond what took place in 167 B.C. I think this goes all the way into the future. Because that's what they'll do. That's what the kingdom of the beast, and that's what this system of idolatry headed up by this city of Babylon, I think it's what they'll do. The nations have come into your inheritance. That's into Jerusalem. Your holy temple they have defiled. That's the abomination of desolation. They have laid Jerusalem in heaps. The dead bodies of your servants they have given as food for the birds of the heavens, the flesh of your saints to the beasts of the earth. Their blood they have shed like water all around Jerusalem. In fact, then there was no one to bury them. Now, that's exactly what they do with the two witnesses that are killed in the streets of Jerusalem. They don't even bury them. They leave their bodies out laying in the streets for everybody to see and everybody to rejoice over. He says, "We have become a reproach to our neighbors, a scorn and a derision to those who are around us." Notice what they ask in verse 5. "How long, O Lord?" Same thing the martyr said in the fifth seal. "How long, O Lord, will you be angry forever with your people Israel? Will your jealousy burn like fire? Pour out your wrath on the nations that do not know you, and on the kingdoms that do not call on your name." Now that's exactly what we saw in Revelation chapter 16. God pouring out on his wrath on those nations and on that kingdom that did not know him. And again, revenging and avenging and judging the blood of these saints who was killed. Look at Revelation chapter 18. Go back there with me again. And look down at verse 24. Last verse in Revelation 18. It describes the destruction of this city of Babylon. And in the very last statement it says this, "And in her," in the city, in this harlot, "was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all who were slain on the earth." That was just characteristic. They killed those who stood for Jesus. They killed those who were God's saints. They killed those who were God's prophets. And so the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, that was what was found. And in fact, the woman, the harlot, this Babylon the Great, was drunk with the blood of these saints. And John, it says, going back to Revelation 17:6, says John was amazed at what he saw. He marveled with great wonder, I think one of the things he must have wondered is what does this all mean? Especially, you've got two visions here. You've got visions of creatures here. You've got the woman, the harlot, and the woman sitting on this scarlet-colored beast. And I'm sure he's wondering, what does this mean? Okay, how can I understand this? And that's what we see as we proceed on into verse 7. Notice what it says. "The angel said to me, 'Why did you marvel? Why are you amazed? Why did you wonder about this?'" He says, and the angel said, "I will tell you. I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns." And that's what we see. Verses 1 through 6, we see this vision that John has given, taken by the Spirit to see it, of the woman and the beast. In verses 7 through 18, we see God's interpretation. Here's the meaning. Here's what it means. "I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her." Look at verse 8. Now, I'm going to go through this rather quickly. If you've got questions, stop me. I'm going to do it quickly because we've talked about it already. When we were in chapter 13 and we were looking at the beast that's described there, we talked about this chapter in relationship to it. So, stop me if there's something you want to clarify. Otherwise, I'm going to just kind of go through it and repeat some of the things we've seen already. Verse 8, "The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit." Now, we've seen creatures ascending out of the bottomless pit before. Remember where that was? Tough to remember to keep all this in your head. Revelation chapter 9, we see the seven trumpets are described. In fact, chapter 9 describes the last three trumpets, who are called woe trumpets. The fifth trumpet is a woe trumpet, and what happens is the bottomless pit is opened, and creatures that are like locusts and have stings in their tails to torment men come up out of that bottomless pit. Now, I don't think they're literal locusts. I think they are demonic creatures that are allowed to come up on the earth that God is going to use as a part of His judgment on the people of the earth in those days. So we've seen demonic creatures coming up out of the bottomless pit. In fact, I think that's where some of them are today. They're there. In fact, if you look in the book of Jude and you look in the book of 1 Peter, maybe 2 Peter, I think it's 2 Peter, it describes the angels who sinned. Some of them were cast down to a place called Tartarus. And the word for Tartarus is a word that means a place of incarceration, or basically a prison cell. I believe that that place Tartarus, is probably the very same thing as this pit of the abyss, or the bottomless pit. So he says, the beast that's described, and we've already described as being the Antichrist, is going to ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. That means ruin, loss, destruction. That's why he's called the son of perdition, because that's what's eventually going to happen to him. Those who dwell on the earth will marvel when this beast ascends up out of the bottomless pit. Now, the ones who will be amazed at him, he says, are those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. So that means they're what? They're unsaved. These are unbelievers. They're the ones who are going to marvel when they see the beast ascending up out of the bottomless pit. When they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Now, what is that talking about? I keep reading and we'll talk about it in just a second. He said, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And there are also seven kings. Now, many believe, and I lean toward this, I think this is probably true, that the seven heads are the seven mountains that he's describing there, represent kingdoms. Okay? That these are kingdoms that will be on the earth in those last days. The seven heads are the seven kings of those seven kingdoms on the earth in those last days. We get that thing, if you read in Isaiah chapter 2, for instance, it describes the kingdom that the Lord will establish on this earth as being the mountain of God. Okay, go up into the mountain of God, into the kingdom that Jesus Christ will rule and reign over. So I believe that's probably what this is describing here. He says these seven kings, or these seven heads, are associated very clearly with this beast, with this Antichrist. Now, notice what it says in verse 10. There are also seven kings. He says five of them have fallen. One is, and the other is not yet come. So five have fallen. One exists right now. That's the sixth one. He says, and the other is not yet come. He says, and when he comes, he must continue a short time. Now, the beast that was and is not is himself, that was and is not, is himself also the eighth king. So the beast is, I believe, the seventh king, but he's also what? He's also the eighth king. Now, how can that be? Now, notice what it says. The beast that was and is not, what's missing? Yet to come. There's no mention of yet to come. What he's describing is how he comes. He's also the eighth, and he is of the seven, which indicates he's the seventh, I believe. He's also the eighth, and he's going to perdition. What is this talking about? Well, I think that goes back to verse 8. The beast that you saw was, and is not, and yet he is. Okay? He is to come. What does that mean? Go back with me to chapter 13 and look at something we saw back there. And this is where we put this together last time. We see the beast described in Revelation 13 verses 1 through 3. We see him given his power, his throne, and his authority by the dragon or by Satan himself. And then in verse 3 we see this statement made. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. And his deadly wound was what? Healed. And what happened? All the world did what? They marveled, and they followed the beast. Now look at 17 again. Notice what it says. Verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit. He says, and those who dwell on the earth will what? Will marvel. When they see, last part of verse 8, when they see the beast that was and is not, and what's the last part? And yet he is. And yet he is. Go back to chapter 13. What do they do? Verse 4. They worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast. They worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him. They worship him because of what happens to him. He receives a deadly wound. Look at chapter 13. Go with me down to verse 14. This is talking about the false prophet when he comes on the scene. This is the false prophet deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword. And yet what happened to him? He lived. Now, we call him the Antichrist, which means in one sense that he's against Christ. He stands in opposition to Christ. But that word anti can also mean in place of. And that's what he's going to produce. What he's going to do is he's going to present himself as the true Christ. He's a false Christ, but he's going to present himself as the true Christ. Well, what's he going to do? He's going to copy Christ. Well, Christ was crucified, and what happened to him? He was raised from the dead. Sadly, all the world didn't wonder after that. But when this one comes, and he is killed with a sword, and his deadly wound is healed, and he lives again, all the world will wonder. Now, I believe that what we're seeing in chapter 17 is that initially he's the seventh king, and he's in a mortal form of some sort. He's a human being like we are. When he's killed and when he's resurrected, I think that's when he ascends up out of the bottomless pit in a demonic form. I think he's going to be either possessed or be a demon in some way or another. And in that final form is how he'll be worshipped. And that's going to happen in the middle of the tribulation period, okay? That's when he's going to get this wound. That's when he's going to be healed. And that's when worship changes, okay? No longer will it be a worship of idols on the earth. It'll be a worship of one. And that is Satan and Satan's man, the Antichrist. And they'll worship him. That's how he's the seventh king. That's also how he's the eighth. Coming up out of the bottomless pit, he is the eighth king, the one that was and is not and yet is as he ascends out of the bottomless pit. What's eventually going to happen to him? Revelation 17, verse 11, last part. He's going to perdition. How will it happen? Well, look at verse 12. Revelation 17, 12. He says, "The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet." So they're kings. They just don't have a kingdom to reign over yet. What happens is they receive authority for 1 hour, for one period of time. I don't know if this is exactly 1 hour he's talking about. He's talking about a single period of time. They receive basically authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind. They will give their power and their authority to the beast. So you've got an alliance of the beast, and you've got ten kings. Now think back to Daniel chapter 2, the image that Nebuchadnezzar pictures or sees. The last kingdom is pictured, I think, by the feet and by the toes. Okay? And those toes have two materials that they're made of. They're part iron, so there's part strength. What's the other part? Clay. Okay? And I think that's what you're seeing here. You're seeing a kingdom here which is partly strong, and that would probably be from the beast himself, and it's partly weak. Okay? It's partly weak, and that's these ten kings. What are they intending to do? Look at verse 14. Here's what they intend to do. And this is what the psalmist says in Psalm 2 when he says that the kings of the earth have plotted and imagined a very vain and futile thing against God and against His anointed, saying, "We're going to break His bonds, and He's no longer going to have control over us at all." These, it says, the ten kings and the beasts, the Antichrist, even in his demonic form, these will make war with who? The Lamb. And it says very simply, "And the Lamb will overcome them. For He is Lord of lords, He is King of kings, and those who are with Him are called, chosen, and faithful." Now, that's, I believe, the Battle of Armageddon, is what's described in that verse. That's when they're going to gather together. That's why we saw in the sixth bowl of judgment that's poured out on the earth, the great river Euphrates is dried up so that the kings of the east can cross that river and gather together at a place called Armageddon, which is the valley or the mountain of Megiddo. And that's where this final battle will take place. It'll be a quick battle, I believe. And it's said very simply, the Lamb will overcome. It's a futile, it's a vain thing that they're imagining and plotting to do. But they're going to be destroyed. And so that's what we see taking place. And so I believe that's what these seven kings or seven heads are. And I think that's what these ten kings are that are described here. The ten horns or ten kings who are going to give their alliance to the beast. And this is what's going to happen to them. Now, what we'll look at next time is we'll look at the close of chapter 17. We'll look at the beginning of chapter 18. But I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about various interpretations of who Babylon, who this great harlot is. Okay? We're going to describe this woman and talk about who she is. There are a lot of different viewpoints on this. Some of them we're not going to look at all. We're going to look at the four different viewpoints that people have, the various systems of interpreting the book of Revelation, and three of those I'm not even going to consider at all. We'll talk about the nature of those and why I think they're not valid at all. We're going to talk about primarily the viewpoints of people who all look at the book of the Revelation as future. And again, there's enough of those, plenty to look at. And we won't look at all of them. I just picked a few for us to pick out and look at. I'll give you my opinion. The book of the Revelation is a very difficult book to understand. You can tell that from our study of it. It's very, it is a revelation, which means it's not something that is hidden from us, but it's not an easy book to read and understand. It's going to be much more clear to the people who live in those days, because they're going to see it unfold. They're going to watch these events unfold. They'll be able to see, that's what that means. That's exactly what that is. We won't be able to tell that as easily. We can compare Old Testament prophecies. We can compare Jesus' prophecies. We can compare what it says in the book of the Revelation and come up with our best guesses and understanding of what it says. But I won't have a final answer for you. This is my opinion on what probably I believe that it means. So we'll look at that next time. I was going to try to do that tonight, but I didn't really feel like I was ready to do it, to be real honest with you. So we'll look at it next time. Hopefully I'll have more time to prepare and look at those things next week. Okay.